grad student. So turns out that last week's episode was released on the podcast's 9-month anniversary. I cannot believe that this podcast has gone on for 9 months. That's like a whole pregnancy. That's a whole baby. Thanks for being my baby. Anyways, it is like 75 out and beautiful this whole week, and I think it's pretty obvious that I have spent way too much time inside, so I'm gonna go get myself outside and get all of you right into today's episode. Today's episode is all about being a visible religious minority and lived experience with mental health in grad school with clinical psychology PhD candidate Noor Sharif. Hello, listeners. Welcome back to Dear Grad Student, the podcast where grad students can come together to celebrate, commiserate, and support one another through this long and difficult journey. I'm Alana. I'm a fourth-year doctoral student and your host, and I'm joined today by a sixth-year PhD candidate studying racialized people's mental health disparities, psychosis, and racial trauma, Noor Sharif. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Very honored to be here.
I'm honored to have you. As we said before we started recording, you have been somebody following the podcast since the very beginning. So I feel like, I don't know, like I'm honored to like have an OG.
Yes, since the very, very, very start of when you made the Twitter and the first episode.
And I mean, you're definitely not the first guest like in that category. We just like happened to be talking about it. And I'm like, oh, like I'm nervous. Like I want to like live up to your expectations of the podcast you've been following on Twitter.
Blew my mind already with everything.
Oh, stop. Well, thanks. Let's go ahead and start this episode like all other episodes and get you a shout out on social media for where people can follow you and find you. So where can the folks connect with you online?
Twitter, for sure. So my Twitter is Noor45251. So Noor45251.
Great. So that will also be linked in the description below. So everybody who is going to obviously love our conversation can go down to the description. They can find you there. They can follow you. For anybody listening who doesn't know this, by the way, there is a list that I have made on Twitter of all of the podcast guests that I've ever had. Every time an episode comes out, I add that person to the list. So if you just are like, Alana, I can't keep up with the guests. Great. Follow the list. And then you could just do it that way. So anyways, that's a thing. I never talk about it on the podcast. I just talk about how that's a thing on Twitter, but Noor will be on that by the time this comes out. You can find it there too. But enough about me. Let's start this now. I want to hear, you know, before we jump into the rest of what we're going to talk about today, I want to like give a little bit of context for what you do in grad school, who you are, like what's your shtick, what's your thing. So what are, you're clinical, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So what are your research and sort of clinical interests as of right now, right? That could evolve and change, but what's your thing in grad school? What are you here for?
Yeah, so I'm a clinical psychology student. I guess my shtick really is wanting to understand and better serve vulnerable and diverse communities. So in terms of research, I study racial trauma, white allyship, racial minority mental health disparities. That's kind of my passion, but I also really love supporting vulnerable communities like people with schizophrenia and psychosis and immigrants and refugees. So kind of my clinical and research areas. I'm also really passionate about, you know, equity, diversity, inclusion work. So I do a lot of advocacy work within psychology, myself among other students that kind of banded together to kind of try to push for changes in psychology, I think, that are necessary for sure.
Yeah. And you are a sixth year, which really in Canada, you're a fourth year because you did a master's first.
Well, most programs are master's first and PhD, but our program is a joint program. So Some people get confused of what year I am, but I'm in my last year.
Yes. Oh, so you are graduating like within the month then?
Well, so in clinical psychology, we have to do a residency.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. So I'm just doing my residency next year. But in terms of my PhD part, right. Yeah, I'm going to be done.
I love how like I switched out of clinical 2 months ago and I'm like, oh, I forgot you have to do internship. Like, I'm so fake. Okay. Obviously, I must have known that. I knew that. Okay. I just like it didn't click for me because I'm like now in the wonderful world of not having to do that. So I'm like, as soon as my dissertation's done, I'm done, which is like what a wonderful place to be. Where are you going next year? Have you matched and done all that already? Figured out where you're landing?
Yes. It was one of the most stressful experiences of my life. getting the APIC match. I would not wish that upon anybody.
Gosh.
It was horrible. I mean, you just have to be honest about it. I mean, everyone survives it, but mm-hmm. it's very unnecessarily stressful and puts a lot of strain on the student when it doesn't need to be that
yeah,
way.
Definitely. Yeah, I've watched many a folk go through the APIC match. For those of you not in clinical psychology or who aren't on Twitter watching that happen every year, essentially, you know, you apply to what, like 10, 15, 20 programs. They sort of like reach out for interviews. And the second you get an email, you have to pick a date and you have to make sure you don't pick the same date for any of them. I mean, I know people who have had like 10 to 15 interviews and it's like the second it comes out, you're picking a date and you're like figuring out how to do those interviews. At least when they used to be in person, especially, it was like booking flights and going out. And then at the end of all of it, you sent a ranked list into APIC and programs rank you. And then it's really similar to like match day for med schools, where if you're first for them and they're first for you, it's a match, but it's hard to get your first choice, as you might imagine. So, you know, you have to really pay attention to where you rank programs and how you do. And it's very stressful.
Yeah. Hard. Yeah. And also kind of thinking about the disparities within that process of diverse people or underrepresented people. They don't have, you know, the funds to go to interviews. And, you know, now that everything is online, it's hopefully going to be more an equitable process moving forward. I know APIC is trying to figure out if they're going to do this long term. And most students are like, yes, please keep it online so we don't have to spend so much money.
Yeah, I will say, you know, our department used to have these like little brown bags for internships. So it'd be like students who just went through the process would like speak to other students, say this every single year after the process is over. And on average, students were paying about $5,000 with like interview travel costs and hotels and all of that just to interview, to land at one place, to move for 1 year, and that's it. I mean, it's like
1 year.
Yeah, at least for residency, you're moving somewhere for like 3 to 4 plus years, like for a doctor residency. For clinical psychology, it is 1 year, and that's it. That's a lot of money to spend for a 1 year placement.
It's a ridiculous process. They need to make changes. Like even in my match tweet, like when I tweeted that I matched, like within that, I was like, this was a horrible process, but I matched. So yay, I guess.
Right. It's one of those things where it's like, how do you complain? Because like you have to take the step and you just feel grateful that it's done and grateful that you did it. And like, yeah, it's just one of those like power dynamics within academia that just continues to function for no good reason. Okay, let's go ahead and jump into today's conversation and topic. You gave me this language before we started recording, and I really, really liked it. But we're going to spend some time today talking about your experience as a visible religious minority in your grad program. Now, you are a Muslim hijab-wearing woman in psychology, in clinical psychology. And I would love to start this out just hearing about, like, what has your experience been like as a Muslim hijab-wearing woman in academia?
Yeah, this is actually really the first time I've openly talked about this, because I, as you can imagine, in grad school, we don't really talk about religion or talk about people's identities openly, mm-hmm. and how that affects the work that we do or how that impacts our training or anything like that. So in clinical psychology, because that's the only place I can speak for,
sure,
there is very, very few religious minorities in the program, you know, as there are very few, you know, racialized people and even fewer religious minorities, right? And even fewer visible ones. Like, I've never met like a Sikh man or, you know, an Orthodox Jewish woman that covers her hair or another Muslim woman that wears a hijab. Like, I have not met anybody like that. So, but in terms of what my experience has been like, it's been a challenge in terms of, especially in the beginning, where do I fit in? Like, do I fit in this space of academia where everything is thought to be a-religious and they don't want to talk about spirituality or consider religious in terms of what we talk about science and saying everything has to be objective. And so religion and spirituality is not part of that process. So it's like, where do I fit in all of this? And so you kind of just have to act like you're a blank slate, even though you know you're not. Mm. So connecting with other religious minorities has been hard. Being able to speak about being a religious minority has been non-existent. And other people, the way they treat me, you don't know in terms of like microaggressions and stuff like that, where that kind of all fits in, being one of the few. So
It's really interesting. One thing I reflected to you again before we started recording, also being a religious minority, is that I am an invisible religious minority by choice, and how that's been a very complicated choice that I've made, and how I do feel a lot of guilt about that. Like, and what I mean by that is I don't walk around wearing a Jewish star. Mm-hmm. I own Jewish star necklaces, and when I'm home, I will wear them. But where I'm currently living, it's something that, at least when I first moved here and onward, it just has not been something that I'm excited to wear out in public. Mm-hmm. And the reason that feels complicated is that I'm basically choosing white majority privilege, where it's like choosing safety is a privilege.
Mm-hmm.
But I do identify with what you said about how science can be very a-religious and that you kind of come as a clean slate. I think that in some ways, and I just saw a conversation on Twitter about this, where people were like, you can, and I think it was around Easter time probably, but people were talking about like, there are scientists who are religious, like they exist, like that can exist at the same time.
Yes. And this is really interesting, because this idea is a very Western perspective, that science is a religious and that religion is not part of the scientific process, or that people doing the science are not religious people. Whereas if you think about science across the globe, a majority of people outside of the West are religious people.
Yeah.
They are born into a religious faith and are practicing, and are in families that are religious, and they grow up religious, like people in the Middle East. There's a lot of science coming out of the Middle East.
Yeah.
People are Muslim or Christian or whatever faith they are. So this is a very North American idea. And I think we get kind of stuck in that place a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's sort of attaches to like the overall problem of like science is objective. It's like, well, science is being done by humans, and that comes with all of the bias of the human experience. So I think that there's this like, oh, we're sort of above this, right? We're above the biases, we're above the whatever. But it's like, at the end of the day, we're not. It's something I actually kind of dislike about this like Americanized science world, that it acts like it's above and beyond human nature, and it's not.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's exactly what it is. It's that this idea that science is objective and that religion or spirituality is not objective, where you're ignoring a huge part of the human experience, that as human beings, we wonder about faith, we wonder about spirituality, we wonder about God, we wonder about our existence. So if you're not involving that human piece of humanity into what we do as scientists, I think you're missing a really big part of what it's like to be a person and understanding the processes that we're trying to study, right?
Yeah. And I mean, I have to imagine that in some way that this interacts with or sort of folds into your clinical experience. I mean, as somebody who at least at one point was being clinically trained, they talk a lot about, you know, cultural competency and also our own positionality and understanding how we as therapists walk into a room. So I'm curious, thinking about the things exactly that you just said, like as humans, we wonder about these things. And even in therapy, just the fact that like we're not trained on how to help people navigate that necessarily. And if we are, it's a very Westernized training and in questioning God and things. Yeah. What's your experience been like clinically with that?
Yeah. So there's two things I want to say. Firstly, that when we're trained in clinical psychology, it's this whole idea of being a blank slate to the client. And so they don't know your religious background, your ethnicity, your, you know, if you're married or not, if you have kids, your belief system, anything like that, which is, I think, a very misinformed approach to doing therapy.
Agreed.
In connection to that, myself as a visible religious person, I don't get that, right? Because clients see me and they know that I am something. They know that I cover my hair. So what does that mean? Is she a Muslim? Is she somebody else? Or does she do that just because? So I'm not offered that idea of a blank slate. So when I was trained, I was actively looking for support and, well, how do I navigate this? Because clients always have questions to me like, well, you cover your hair. So are you a Muslim, or are you a person of faith, or are you Sikh, or do you just cover your hair because? And other people don't get those types of questions, right? Because they're the blank slate that all clinical psychologists are trained in.
Yeah.
It's a very white, Westernized perspective.
Absolutely.
So that's the first thing, that religious minorities and all type of minoritized people, we don't get that blank slate idea, right? It doesn't make sense because we are not a blank slate, because clients see they have ideas and perspectives of what we're like and what we believe. So I didn't get a lot of support in that. It's like my supervisor, like, I don't know what to do about that. Like, I don't know how to navigate that.
Okay.
And the other thing is, in terms of the client, is that in psychology and training, we're not trained on how to work with clients that are people of faith, first of all, but also when they have religious questions or existential issues, we're not trained on how to deal with that. A lot of the clients, because I work with people that a lot of people with schizophrenia, it's very huge loss of functioning, and it's very, very challenging. They go from, you know, having full-time jobs to, you know, being housebound. And a lot of the time it's the questions, well, why did this happen to me? There, a lot of the time they're people of faith. Why did God punish me? Or did I sin? Or why is this happening to me? What does this mean about my life or my existence, that I'm not doing anything useful anymore, which is a problematic idea in the first place.
Yeah, there were air quotes when Nora said that. Let's be really clear.
Yeah. So, and it's like, you know, my supervisor just kind of like, I don't know.
I mean, and it's a tough question, right? I mean, I think it's a tough one for anyone. And I think this really speaks exactly to that point of where we miss the mark at times. I mean, when you talk about that blank slate thing, it really spoke to me. It reminds me, you know, when we were being trained that, like, women who wear wedding rings are told, like, don't wear a ring to see your client. And it's like, at some level, it's like, well, then you get questions and session isn't about you. And that, like, at times clients can sort of divert the conversation to you if they want to avoid talking about something. And it's like, to really have to show up in a room inauthentically, not as yourself, is very difficult. It's part of the reason, actually, why clinical psychology was not a good fit. I have a very, very hard time masking all of this. And I fit that blank slate mold pretty well. I'm not married. I mean, I'm bisexual, but I don't walk around with rainbows all over my body. I don't have, like, a visible I'm a bisexual tattoo on my arm that's, like, labeling me or something. So I can walk in pretty blank slate, and it was still a lot of erasure that I just, like, couldn't show up as not all these pieces. So it affects every single person, and it's more difficult for people who can't show up that way. And the fact that the training isn't really there for that, I mean, you just hit it nail on the head. Like, in a way, I think that we are failing clients by not showing up. Like, the clients that I did show up to myself as, like, when I had DBT clients, you know, they tell you to show up a little bit more as yourself and you can, like, whatever. Those were some of my more enjoyable times, just because I very much was able to sort of be me. I don't know. I think the clients benefit from a human being. And when we can't be that, I don't know.
No, 100%. And I think this is where I think psychology has a hard time moving on from, because psychology, it's really, they have a really hard time moving on from tradition. They so hard to let go of just traditions that they've done for so many years, even though they don't make sense anymore. So this whole idea of, you know, not sharing your authentic self, not being a human being with a client, being a blank slate, this whole idea of self-disclosing, this is such a big, huge deal. Like, did you tell them you were, you know, had a family member that passed away? And this is like this whole, like, discussion on sharing your humanity and sharing yourself as another human being with a client is such a huge deal still in psychology, when it's like, we're moving away from this because clients are also people and I'm also a person. And so we need this natural human interaction, not me being this enigma that a client doesn't know. It seems this whole hierarchical still idea in therapy that we kind of hold on to for just the sake of tradition.
Yeah. So how have you navigated that then? Because if no one really quite knew what to do, where have you landed with it?
So I've landed on exactly what you're saying, be honest and authentic. And so I would say not all of my clients, but a big portion of them ask me about my faith. Like, oh, are you a person of faith? Usually is what they ask. Or are you Muslim? And I'm just like, yes, I am. So I've never shied away from that, because it's kind of obvious at times. So having that conversation with clients, like, I'm a Muslim person and I'm a person of faith, and just kind of exploring, like, what was their interest in that? Is that relevant to them? Is it a comfort to them that I am another person of faith? And usually they ask because they want to bring up topics about faith.
Sure.
And I've had a few clients when I was doing my placements in private practice where we had like our own profiles online and clients can choose who they want to work with. You know, I had many clients being like, yeah, I want to work specifically with you because I knew you were a person of faith and so am I. These are things I think a lot of clinicians and people in training don't have to really work with or deal with. And I think it does a disservice to a lot of clients who want to bring up faith issues or religious issues and they don't feel comfortable because of the way that we're trained, that we don't even ask about it, right?
Yeah, or like we'll ask about it way, way later than we should, or in a really awkward way of like, so are you... You know, I mean, we're not trained to ask it that way, but it's a little bit awkward because a lot of times there's not like a good, I don't know, like transition into getting into that conversation. And like as therapists, we shouldn't feel uncomfortable. But you kind of answered a question I was going to ask, which is that are most of your clients either Muslim or people of faith? And it sounds like because you are transparent and you are authentically yourself, that more people who may have the same identity or something that can relate to you, that you see more clients with those identities. And I just wish people would see that as like, hello, more beneficial to clients when we show up as ourselves. Like when I think about the kind of therapist I would want, I really don't want a brick wall.
Right.
That doesn't seem like as helpful. Like I would really like to connect with someone to feel like I'm being heard and understood. And I think you're right. It's just sort of a stuck with tradition issue. One other thing I realized that I've accidentally done, because I know why women wear hijab, but we should probably explain, why do Muslim women wear hijab and why do other women not who are Muslim? Just for people listening who maybe are like, why are you choosing to be visible versus not, or is it a choice or not? I think that that would be important. I probably should have started with that. Sorry, everybody, 20 minutes in now. But why don't we answer that really quick, just to give some context as to why you show up authentically that way?
Yeah, for sure. So I think probably the reason why we don't talk about it is because it's still a huge topic of debate, right? And you see in, you know, especially European countries, this whole wanting to police, you know, Muslim women and what they wear, mm-hmm. which is just as bad as forcing women to wear hijab. You know, forcing women not to wear hijab is just as bad as forcing them to wear it, right? Because you're just policing women's bodies and what they want to do. So that's probably why people shy away from this discussion, is because it's still very, very much trying to control what women wear in a lot of governments and countries. But to answer the question, why do women wear hijab in Islam? Some interpretations is around dressing modestly and being modest. And a part of that is potentially covering your hair and covering your neck. So some people, it's either covering their hair and their neck, or covering their hair, their neck, and, you know, their whole bodies, so that you can't, you know, see, you know, their parts of their bodies and stuff like that, because for the sake of wanting to be modest. Other different types of interpretations is around just wanting to control what the public sees and not sees of yourself. So a woman having control of, you know, what they show to the public and what they want to wear. So there's different interpretations. So some Muslim women don't wear hijab. They don't believe in it, fully their choice. Some women want to wear hijab to be identified as a Muslim. I'm a Muslim. This is what I want to wear. This is how I want to present myself into society.
Yeah. I mean, I think at the end of the day, the important takeaway is that people should be able to do what they want generally for whatever reason.
Exactly.
It doesn't hurt somebody else. You know, it's interesting too, as you were talking, something that I was realizing that is, I guess in my mind, proof that it really is like Islamophobia or whatever you want to call it, that this is targeted at Muslim women, is Jewish Orthodox women also cover their hair. They just wear wigs.
Mm-hmm.
And people don't talk about that in the same way. Like, so I was raised Orthodox, as we talked about a bit before we started recording. And my mom covered her hair almost my whole childhood, probably till I was, I don't know, like 7 or 8. And then my family just sort of unfolded out of like super religious life. But I have a ton of Orthodox friends from home, and I guess I was just like around people covering clothes to their elbows or knees. Like it's very like kind of normal for me, like that I was just around that. Women cover their hair except for when they're at home and with their husbands. I want to say, and I'm probably going to get this interpretation wrong, so if there are Orthodox Jewish grad students listening and I totally fuck this up, just DM me. But my understanding from like my Hebrew school teacher was that it was, hair is not that it's like sacred, but like it's like a part of a very like authentic, intimate part of you that like only family and like God see. So like after a whole year of teaching Hebrew school, like my one teacher had all the girls go into the girls' bathroom so we could like see her real hair, and she took off her wig. And that was like after knowing her a whole year, and it was like kind of an intimate thing for her to be like, this is like a gesture of like, you girls are my girls, and like we just had a good year. So after women get married, they just cover their hair. But because it's not this image of, I guess, a specific kind of cloth, you don't hear the same. It's the same thing. I mean, maybe for different reasons, modesty is also part of it, but like it's the same thing, which is why it always bugs me when people have an issue with it. And I guess it's maybe why I've never had a problem with it, because I'm like, people can do whatever they want. I don't know. Religious freedom, maybe? Anyways.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And this is why we know that these laws and stuff like that are targeted specifically toward Muslim women, because there are other people of women of faith that do cover. So, you know, you mentioned Orthodox Jewish women, they cover their hair. Some Christian women, they do also cover their hair. Mm-hmm. Certain denominations of Sikhism, the women cover their hair. So why is this specifically targeted at Muslim women? So it's like they try to present it as like a general thing. No, nobody can cover, blah, blah, blah. But it's really targeted towards Muslim women. And that's really what it is. It's controlling women's bodies and what women wear, and this whole idea that women don't know any better. So we need to step in for them and, you know, liberate them in this whole white savior complex that people have, right?
Yeah, big yikes. Not to say that, like, I mean, it's not like the laws were written where it's like hair covering. Like, it's hijab. Not to say that there isn't. I know that France is especially what we're thinking about now, because they just passed those just awful laws. Not to say that there's not rampant anti-Semitism in France, because I think it's probably one of the worst countries in Europe for that right now. But it didn't say hair covering of religious women. Right? It said hijab. So very, very problematic. Thank you for sharing and helping people understand who listening maybe didn't know why people wear hijab. But I also want to talk a little bit about, like, we've heard some experiences clinically in training and clinically with folk, and also just your experience being a visible minority and just the fact of knowing that at all twists and turns of this process. You've also had your own mental health journey in grad school. Hey, it's me. You all know that I love talking about academic mental health on this podcast, and Nora and I are actually about to jump into her journey with mental health. But before we do, I just want to remind everybody about a really special sponsor for the podcast related to mental health. Today's episode is being sponsored by BetterHelp. BetterHelp is the world's largest online counseling service. They assess your needs and they match you with your own licensed professional therapist. It's available worldwide, and you can access your account at any time and send a message to your counselor or schedule your weekly sessions, all online. Plus, if you decide that your counselor isn't a good match, which, you know, it happens, it is easy and, more importantly, it is free to switch counselors if you need to. BetterHelp is more affordable than traditional offline counseling, and there are lots of different kinds of therapists, all with different identities, who work for them. There's even financial aid available, which I really like, because it means that this is a more accessible option for grad students, you know, in addition to the fact that they offer more diverse therapists or more therapy modalities than might be available in your area. So as a Dear Grad Student listener, you can get 10% off your first month at BetterHelp.com/DearGradStudent. That's BETTERHELP. Again, the full link for 10% off your first month is BetterHelp.com/DearGradStudent. You can also find that link at the bottom of the episode description or on the support page of the podcast website. All right, I know I got everyone excited for Nora's mental health journey. Let's go ahead and jump back into the episode. You were so outspoken with me where you were like, I really want to talk about this. I want to talk about my mental health journey. I want people to know that, like, you can come back from anything. And I really love that. I mean, people know I love talking about mental health on this podcast and normalizing it. So I want to hear, you know, what have you been through with your mental health in grad school?
Yeah, so I've had a very unconventional process or experience in grad school where most grad students haven't had, just in general. So I came into my program with one specific supervisor, and that supervisor ended up being very abusive. And this is not a unique experience, though. That part is not unique. A lot of grad students experience supervisors that are not super nice and
like toxic,
very toxic and abusive, and they don't know what to do. So at some point I had to switch supervisors, and that was a really, really tough process for me because I love my research in terms of studying racialized people and ethnic minorities and stuff like that. And it was a question of, I have to leave this behind because that person was the only person at the time that did that research.
That's hard.
It was a really, really hard decision to make. It's like, am I going to leave this, my passion behind, and pursue something else? And in the end, I had to make that decision because that supervisor was like outright like yelling at me, calling me in the middle of the light, like middle of the night, like screaming and stuff like that. It was a horrible experience. So I had to leave that supervisor, but I also didn't get a lot of support from my department in terms of switching supervisors. It was like, okay, you want to switch? But I was like, yeah, I want to switch. But they were also a very abusive person. And they're like, yeah, well, you can just find somebody else. So it's like, they didn't really do anything. So I found another supervisor, and my current supervisor is wonderful. But just experiencing that really made me very vulnerable mental health wise, because I had this idea coming into grad school of what it would be like, especially working with clinicians and people that are in mental health. And you think they would be a lot more supportive and their personalities would be a lot nicer and stuff like that. So,
yes.
And that image was shattered. And this is the thing I've talked about with other grad students. They've experienced the same thing, this shattering of this image of what grad school would be like.
You are just speaking to my soul in a way right now. I can't even begin to tell you, but please continue.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what a lot of people say, right? So I was already, after that experience, I was very vulnerable. And, you know, being a minoritized person, being a racialized person, and coming from my parents are from Iraq. And, you know, at the time there was, you know, the war in Iraq happening. So all my family was there. And that's another aspect that, you know, students' identities that grad school doesn't really consider people. It's like some people are from war-torn countries where there's still family there and they don't know what's going to happen to them. It's like, well, that's kind of your thing to deal with. But at the time, my dad was actually in Iraq. My dad has since passed, but he was in Iraq at the time. And there were protests happening around the time. There was a lot of destabilization in Iraq because of the war that happened. And I was like mortified. I was like, is my dad going to get killed in Iraq? While I was trying to like do grad school, switching supervisors. And then one of my closest friends died by suicide, actually.
Oh, gosh, I'm so sorry.
Yeah, and that just kind of like tipped me over the edge. And yeah, so I went through a like major depressive episode and a mental health crisis, essentially, because I had all these horrible things kind of piled up, very unsupported. I didn't feel that my department or my school was really there for me to help me through that process. I felt very alone in that experience. And through that process, like I had to drop out from two practicum like placements. Wow. I got no support through that. So I ended up failing one of them because I quit. It was really an awful experience.
Oh man.
Yeah. So I was kind of on the verge of like, do I drop out or am I going to get kicked out? That was essentially what was happening because I was failing. I wasn't keeping on top of anything and I wasn't getting any support. And I was just kind of like in a major depressive episode. And the anxiety that comes with that, it was just a really, really bad experience. So it came to a point where I was like, okay, I have to take time off. My school's not supporting me. So I need to support myself because I'm not getting anywhere with them. So I ended up taking time off and, you know, getting help, the right help, and really building up my support system of my friends and being, you know, honest with them, being like, hey, like I'm going through this and I really need help. And they were amazing and they were really supportive. You know, I went to therapy, I went on medication. I took time off to really like address a lot of the issues that I was experiencing and just hoping the stressors of my life would kind of chill.
Yeah.
And then I came back, and the coming back was hard because I don't know if this is a good reason, but I was very spiteful.
Girl, we are the same.
I was very spiteful because in the process when I was going through a mental health crisis, people, like some administrators in my department, were saying, well, maybe you're not cut out for this. Maybe you should switch to something that's a little bit easier.
I'm tired.
Yeah. Or stop maybe you should it. master out. And I was like, no. I was like, no, that's not happening.
Y'all can see my face right now. I'm tired. Oh, what is that? Like,
it's why that's your automatic reaction. It's like, maybe you're just not strong enough for this. You just leave.
Like, I love that. Like, after like the fifth or sixth moment of them not institutionally supporting you, maybe it's you. Okay. Yeah, sure. That's what it is. Come on. Okay. Also, the spiteful thing, I'm like laughing at that because I want to show you. No one else can see this, but I have this taped above my computer because after following a recent conversation, but it says, yes, I fucking can. And yes, I fucking will.
Right.
Because I'm also spiteful just regarding certain situations that are unimportant in the context of this podcast that I'm not liable for. No, just kidding. But same. Because when I'm told that I can't do something or I'm not cut out for something, I'm like, oh, yeah? We'll find out.
Yeah.
It's super unhealthy, but I like it.
Yeah, so that's what I was saying. I don't know if it's a good reason, but it's a reason.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's a good reason either, but I think at some level, it is a good motivation to be like, I mean, we use this in therapy, right? It's just like motivational interviewing. It's like that reverse psychology of like, you shouldn't have been told that you couldn't do it. But if someone tells you you can't and you're like, hang on, I really do want this. I really do want to do that. Like, that can at least be a positive force in your life if you don't use it unhealthily. Like, you shouldn't have been told that in the first place. And I mean, you're just hearing things I tell myself, obviously. This is just like my own self-comfort and self-talk. But like, let it motivate you if it does, you know? Like, if this is really what you want, you can make it happen. And at the same time, you never should have been put in that same that position.
Yeah, that's exactly what I say too. It's like, it doesn't matter if it's a bad reason, it's still a reason and it's still motivating you in a positive direction, as long as it's not pulling you down or making you spiteful in life in general.
Yeah.
And you're using that for a positive force. I think that's totally okay. I think that's a very legitimate motivator. And so that's why when people say like, oh, you shouldn't do things because of spite or because you want to prove people wrong, it's like, well, why not? Like, if that's going to help me get to where I want to go, I don't see there's a problem. I mean, now it's very different. My motivators are very different.
Yeah.
But coming out of that really, really dark place of, you know, being extremely depressed and feeling very alone, not being feeling like I wasn't supported by my school and that I was kind of out to dry on my own and figure it out by myself, I was like, yeah, I'm going to do this just to prove them all wrong because they clearly doubted my ability.
Well, right. And I think there's a difference between like carrying around negativity, like you were saying, versus being like, no, I know what's right for me, or I know what I want in my life, and I'm at least going to give it the best shot that I can.
Yeah.
I said in one of my previous episodes, I think it was with Brianna Williams, my gap year episode, I'm sure I'll reference that literally all the time, about how like I went to grad school straight from undergrad because of two reasons, spite and anxiety. And here I am. But I will say that like spite is strong. There are so many people who joke but are not joking, like online, where they're like, they're just in grad school because someone told them they could never do it.
Exactly.
Like, why are you in academia? Someone told me I couldn't be.
There you go.
Everyone.
Yeah. And I just also want to bring this back to, you know, minoritized people or people of diverse identities, that if we have the right support and right mentorship, because we're coming into these programs without the proper mentorship for diverse people, or, you know, we're in toxic environments that only validate white culture or white ways of doing things in terms of professionalism and stuff like that. So we're a lot of the time at a very big disadvantage, and we end up having a lot more mental health issues and a lot more, you know, negative experiences. And it's not that we're not good enough. It's that we're not being supported through that to get through those situations. So it's not that I wasn't working hard enough, or wasn't that, you know, I couldn't do it. It's that if I had the right support to get me through those situations, or if I didn't have to come into a toxic academic environment, as a lot of us do as minoritized people, maybe those things wouldn't have happened, right?
Yeah.
I could have not failed that placement or not had to take so much time off to just address it by myself, right? So
Absolutely. I mean, it makes things harder than they need to be. And I actually want to shift to our last sort of topic of what we were hoping to chat about to sort of tie all of this even more, you know, together with this bow and just talk about some of the advocacy and the equity, diversity, and inclusion work that you do. I know that this has been motivated in part by the identity that you have and also by the experiences that you've had. But what have you been doing in that area of like advocacy and DEI work, especially as it relates to the experiences you've had? Like, what work do you do with that now?
Yeah, so coming out of trying to support myself through mental health crises and through mental health issues and stuff like that, I really learned to be more authentic to myself and not really be like, I want to fit into this academic mold of what people think a student is or what people think an academic is. I'm just going to be myself, and that's enough. That's more than enough, actually, right? And because I felt so left out and unsupported, I didn't want other minoritized people, especially racialized people, to experience what I had to experience. And it made me realize how much needs to change. And I said, I want to be part of this change. I know things are going to change, and I want to be part of that because of my experience. And I don't want other students coming into this program having to experience that. Yeah, so I started doing a lot of advocacy work with other students. So I'm not solo, of course, because that's, you know, something really, really hard to do as a student.
Yeah.
But kind of on a national level. So I'm in Canada. So on a national level, you know, a lot of us students banded together and was like, hey, things need to change in psychology. There needs to be more diversity. There needs to be more support for trainees. We need to focus on different things. Things that we're not focusing on right now, but also on a university level where, you know, we're pushing for a lot more, you know, diversity in, you know, psychology programs and trying to get more mentorship for people in the programs, but also not just on kind of a, you know, BIPOC or racialized people focus, but also on a, you know, people with lived experience front. It's the irony of psychology is that we're in psychology, mental health, but mental health, the experiences of mental health and, you know, mental health issues is so incredibly stigmatized.
Yeah.
And is seen as a liability rather than a expertise of lived experience, right?
Say that.
Yeah. So that's kind of the two things that I'm really passionate about, diversity in psychology and also, you know, decolonial and anti-racist clinical practice, which is another thing that we're really pushing for, but also destigmatizing the lived experience of mental health in trainees, in academics, and on admissions. So not saying, oh, I don't think you should talk about your mental health, you know, experiences on your application, which I understand because people see it as a liability, but we need to also make changes in normalizing that and seeing that as a testament to someone's, you know, ability, resilience, understanding of mental health and mental health system. And, you know, working with clients is that's an actual, a good thing that someone has experienced their own mental health issues and working with clients and not like someone that's fragile or a liability.
Yeah, it also is like kind of hypocritical when we think about how many grad students have mental health things, which are caused by grad school and not even necessarily toxic environments, although maybe any environment that causes that a toxic, but like just the like run of the mill grad school experience causes depression and anxiety. So it's like, I don't know who they're kidding when they're like, oh, we don't want people with mental health issues. We just want to give people mental health issues. It's like, okay, no. But I'll also say like, so I have PMDD, premenstrual dysphoric disorder. And to the clients that I have spoken about that with when I was seeing clients was usually like them breathing a breath of fresh air of, oh, you kind of actually get it.
Mm-hmm.
How relieving, how nice that I'm seeing someone who's actually been through something or experienced something. Back to who wants a therapist that can't relate to them? Anyways.
Absolutely. And this is one of the big discussions that's happening right now in clinical psychology, but obviously it's been happening for a long time, but sure. I think a lot more now is that this destigmatizing lived experience because we can relate to people more. I can relate to my clients better now because of what I went through. Mm-hmm. It's not that I'm more vulnerable or it's not that I'm more fragile. It's that I'm more relatable to my clients and they can relate better to me. So making me a better therapist for them. Because yeah. I know what it's like. I have been there. Not to say, and again, because this is always a point that comes up. It's like, well, does that mean that if you haven't had lived experience and you can't understand? No, you can't, but it's a different level of connection with clients if you have been through it yourself. And I think that's a very, it makes you a better therapist in that sense.
I mean, definitely. And I think that you speaking to that stigmatization is it's so palpable. Just when I think about like, if somebody wants to be an astronaut, or like they really want to be like a geologist. I don't know. This is a good example, right? Like they grew up collecting rocks their whole life. Well, I can't talk about growing up collecting my rocks if my rocks are mental health things my whole life and having that be the reason I'm interested in going into psychology. It's like you can't be the kid who grew up always wanted to be a psychologist because you or a family member went through something. And like that's just inauthentic. Mm-hmm. I mean, like who went into psychology for not that reason? Like again, maybe some people did, but like I went into it because I was interested in human behavior and I had been through things and like I wanted to better understand how that functions for people. And it evolved into my current research interests, but like it just, you have to be so fake about it. Like it just like that gets to me where like in every other area of science, you can talk about the passion your whole life for this one thing or that one experience that did it, but not in psychology because we stigmatize our own work.
Yes. Anyways. And that's what I find so frustrating in psychology is how like we should be as a field because we're psychology, because we're mental health, we should be championing destigmatizing mental health in professions and in academia. We should be the ones being like, we're open to people that have lived experience instead of being like, oh, I don't want to take them on because.
Well, and like, don't you want to take people on who already have experience managing mental health and managing their mental health in grad school?
You would think, right?
That's
the logical thing to think. But no, because I saw this with my own eyes happening where, you know, students were rejected from, you know, important roles because they disclosed about their lived experience of mental health and supervisor like, I don't want to have to deal with that. Mm. So in psychology, and this is all what the research says, is that a majority of people go into psychology because they want to understand their own mental health issues. And I feel there's such a disconnect between that understanding and that reality and what we actually do in the field and how we practice. And I think there needs to be something there to connect that. And it's not such a big deal when someone discloses that they have mental health issues. It's like, yeah, we all, you know, a lot of us experience that and normalizing that experience and seeing that as a testament to someone's strength and resilience and understanding that they've gone through, you know, mental health and they want to support people that gone through the same thing.
I mean, and I would even like to take a more radicalized approach and say that it's actually discriminating against disabled people to be excluding people. Yeah, you said absolutely. I mean, I think it's actually a discrimination. I don't know if we'll ever get to a place in my lifetime where that's understood, but I do think that it's discrimination. And I really love what you said before about how psychology should be championing this movement. And I think we're the ones holding it back.
Yes.
Because I think some people are trying to do that and we're not backing them up. And then it's like, oh, what does that say?
Exactly. Yeah. So individual people are trying to make a change, but as a profession, as a field, we're not doing that on a grand scale as we should be. So people are left on their own disclosing, saying this is discrimination, saying that it's important to include people with lived experience and that this is an important part of, you know, being a psychologist or any type of mental health practitioner. And so they're kind of left on their own. And I think we as a field should be doing this as a movement to show other professions and fields that, yes, you can be a very good professional, even if you have mental health issues and it's not a liability. It's not going to make you a worse worker. It's not anything like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, big shocker here, the Dear Grad Student podcast has somehow divulged now into clinical psychology, you know, a critical review once again. But hey, that's just what we do here. But I think that it really ties into the things that you have talked about. I think most people listening are either in clinical psychology or have been in therapy or are kind of curious, because we also aren't really allowed to talk about our experiences openly about like being in training or like whatever. And part of that's confidentiality. So like totally. But the other part is this like weird secretive, it's like a secret society, like shamey thing that's like, I think is bullshit.
That's a whole other thing. Because this is something I talk about a lot, is how psychology and clinical psychology specifically is one of the most gatekept professions that exist.
Yeah.
It is so strongly gatekept by people that have been trained in kind of the old ways. I don't know how else to say it.
Yeah.
And they have these, such a strong idea of what a psychologist looks like. And that's usually a white person that, you know, is a blank slate, that doesn't have mental health issues, that doesn't have lived experience at all. So these things tend to be, you know, secrets that we can't talk about these openly. And we need to, if we want to progress as a field, we have to be more open. This is inevitable. It's going to happen. So you're either part of that change or you're going to be in history as someone against the opening of psychology and being making it different and making it more accessible and making it more diverse and us reflecting the populations that we serve. I think, you know, we all need to be doing this.
I love that. Somehow, we are at the very end of recording now, and yep. I can't think of a better way than that last phrase that you gave. I was like, on every edge of your words, I was like, yeah, and then that, and then that. So that was excellent. I do want to make sure we end this episode with some final thoughts. As I have predicted, and as I say every episode, we went a million places, and I want to make sure that listeners can remember some of the big things that we hit. Just a little bit of summarizing, some bullet points, just two or three of main things we covered that you want people to remember after listening to your episode. And just because I have manners, you can go first. But Noor, what would your final thoughts for this episode be?
I think my final thought, of course, I've talked about my identity as a Muslim person, a Muslim woman in psychology, and my lived experience with someone with mental health, and how, you know, my experience really, really opened my eyes to how many problems there are in academia and how many problems there are in psychology as a field. And I think what I kind of want to leave listeners to think about is, where do we go from here? There are so many of us with diverse identities that want to get into psychology, but are getting lost in the pipeline, and that we're left in these programs without any support or any proper mentorship around being a diverse person in these programs. And then we're kind of struggling on our own. So where do we go from here? We need administrators, people in power, leaders of our field to help us move forward, to help us open the doors to our field to diverse people of all identities and people with lived experience. We need to change, and it can't be up to individual people, and it can't be up to vulnerable students to lead these changes. It has to come from leaders in our field.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that is a great sort of final thought, because not only does it summarize what we talked about, but it kind of talks about like next steps and what is needed in this movement. So I love that. I think that my final thoughts, yeah, we did go a lot of places this episode. I kind of want to speak to one thing we didn't directly say, but something that you had said to me that I hope sticks with people, which is that, you know, no matter what you're going through, or if you are somebody taking time off right now, I actually think you are the first grad student I've had on here who has taken time off during their program, that you can come back from that and have success. That is not like the kiss of death or like some sort of sentence on your career, right? Like there is hope, and, you know, Noor is an example of that, but not in like an inspiration-y way, just like a, like you're still going through your life and you're still working through what you're going through, and you were able to work out how to do that in these new circumstances. And so that would be one takeaway of like, taking time off is not like it, and it's okay if you need to take time off, and if, you know, institutions aren't supporting you, like that's not your fault. And I would also just like tying it back to our sort of general conversation at the beginning about your experience as a visible religious person in academia, just for those of us who are either in the majority religion-wise or who are more invisible, like I am definitely within that category, make sure that we're doing what we can to support visibly religious and minoritized students. So for example, like if there are, you know, microaggressions that go down in class, maybe chat with that student about what might be helpful for them, and don't just like speak up for them, but like talk to your fellow student. You know, if there are holidays and things coming up, like just wishing them a happy whatever it is. Like when it was Passover and I had like my Catholic friends like texting me happy Passover, I was like, wow, like they remember that I have a major religious holiday, you know, little things like that, just to help a person feel seen. I guess that's from my own experience. I obviously don't want to speak for you, Noor, but that was something that I was thinking about. Just like think about how we can show up better for people in religious minoritized statuses, because that just interacts with science in such a unique way.
Yeah. And maybe I can add to the final thoughts.
For sure. I know I went back. I know.
Yeah. And I think your first point about having experiences of mental health issues and that being the kiss of death, right? And having to leave your program temporarily and being like, this is it. I'm done. I'm going to have to drop out, or I'm going to have to get kicked out, or, you know, my reputation is sought and people are not going to want to work with me. It's absolutely not the case. And I really want to urge people to, students, to hear this and think, and I hope they get this message across, to advocate for yourself and being able to share your experiences with other students, because when you share your experiences with other people, they are also going to be opening up, and they're the ones who are also going to be sharing their experiences as well. And you start to see how normal it is for all of us to experience mental health issues in grad school, and that it only takes one person to be open so that other people can be open. In addition to that, in terms of advocacy and advocating for yourself, if you're having mental health issues, don't suffer in silence. Use your support system. Even if your department is not supportive, letting them know that that's happening and see what can be done. And hopefully they want to work with you to try to help you through that process so that you don't have to leave programs. And life goes on. You can do it. I believe in you all.
Oh, God. I love that. Also, I love the phrase, like, don't suffer in silence. I think that that is really powerful. And I also would just like to actually just really thank you for coming on and speaking today about some of these points, because exactly what you said about normalizing is something that you are now doing for the hundreds of people that listen to this podcast. So thank you for being a voice in the normalizing of mental health conversations that this is now a part of officially for this podcast, and especially for those people who are listening who are also in religious minoritized statuses, whether visible or invisible. Thank you for being a voice for that.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, to the people who are minoritized religious people, you know, we're out here. There are allies that we can rely on, as you mentioned, that it's really important to be an ally to people that are religious minorities, because there's so few of us. And, you know, how we conceptualize science and academia, it's not easy for us to be open about our beliefs and our, you know, religious practices and stuff like that. So yeah, you know, wishing someone happy Ramadan or happy Passover or whatever it is, it really is such a huge thing for us to hear that people do know and they do care and they are educated and they are knowledgeable about, you know, our practices and stuff like that. So
happy Ramadan. I know I said it at the beginning, but I was like, should I do it live? Because you're doing that right now. So there you go. I'm demonstrating for the listeners. It's that easy. So especially if you have friends with like different religious statuses, just like kind of have a general gist of when their holidays are, like, you know, send them little Bitmojis on for their holiday, because Bitmoji does that now. But yes, thank you so much for the voice that you brought to this, Noor. I do want to remind people listening where they can connect with you online. So where can people follow you online, maybe DM you or tweet at you if they're totally vibing with what you're saying today? Where can they find you?
Yeah, Twitter, definitely. So my Twitter is Noor45251, Noor45251. So you can chat and connect.
There you go. Yeah, her DMs are open. She will also be linked in the description of it, as I have said so, so many times. But Noor, it was an absolute joy to have you on the podcast. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me. I loved it.
Of course. And thanks for being such a supporter of the podcast. Of course, I very much appreciate that. And I'm like, kind of like, thank you. Like, I feel like I'm nervous around people who like the podcast. And I'm like, I gotta chill out. Like, I feel like people are fans of me, but I'm fans of my fans. And I'm like, how do I act around you so you still like me, even if I'm not as cool in real life because I'm weird?
Yeah, you and what you've been able to accomplish here kind of pretty much totally on your own, which is amazing.
Noor, thank you so much again for the millionth time for coming and chatting with me today. Listeners, thank you so much for listening, and I will talk to you next week. Hashtag bye.
Bye.
Wow, what another incredible episode of Dear Grad Student. Not to just, you know, brag on myself, but wow, incredible. And are you looking for more ways to connect with Dear Grad Student? Well, you can find the podcast at the new fancy podcast website, all made possible by podcast patrons. You can find the website at deargradstudent.com. You can also find the podcast on Twitter at Dear Grad Student, on Instagram at Dear Grad Student Pod, and automated closed captionings can be found on some videos on YouTube by searching Dear Grad Student Podcast. If you would like to join the wonderful group of people supporting the podcast on Patreon, you can go to patreon.com/deargradstudent. We are only a few patrons away from 20 patrons. I would love to hit that for my birthday, which is June 24th. I would just love it so much. If you just want to connect with me online, you can find me on Twitter at @Elana_Gloger. That's ELANA_GLOGER. And if you like what you heard today, you can tell everybody that you know, or hear me out, or you could buy merch like a mug or a sticker or a magnet. You can put those things everywhere, and then you don't have to talk to real people ever. And you can find that merch at Dear Grad Student's website, clicking the merch button, or on Redbubble. And if you can, please rate, review, and follow Dear Grad Student on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or, you know, wherever you find your other favorite shows. As a reminder, all resources and links mentioned in today's episode can be found in the description. And until next time, warmest regards, best wishes, sincerely, Elana.